Thank you so much, Hira. Thank you, everybody, for being here with us. And without further ado, let's delve on into the next chapter, both in Judges, but also the next chapter in Gideon's family saga. Last week, we saw that Gideon is, in many ways, a high point in the book of Judges. He is a man who thinks in national terms, who thinks outside of the box, who thinks about the people and their suffering, not just his own experiences. And he leads the people to a great victory. Yet towards the end of his life, we see that despite his great victory, the message that God wanted him to teach, the message that God wanted to pass on by limiting the number of fighters, for example, the message that Gideon was totally behind when he said, I will not be your king, for and I am not your savior, God is your savior. Namely, the message that it is God working behind the scenes to redeem the people and not happenstance, their own strength, real politics, or anything like that. That message doesn't stick. The people use an ephod, some sort of ritual object that Gideon created out of the gold of the booty from the war. He created it as commemorate God's victory, and they turn it into an object of worship in its own right. They disconnect a tool from the source that gives it power. It's as if I would take the computer I have right now that's attached to the cloud, which allows me to speak to you live right now, and say, oh, this piece of plastic is in itself what allows me to communicate with you, without realizing that there's a lot more behind that, a lot more that it's connected to. And this failure, in many ways, lies like a shadow over Gideon's memory, but it also foreshadows the fact that Gideon's legacy isn't going to stick. And it's not only not going to stick on a national level, much as all the other judges can't make their legacy stick on the national level, because with every generation, they once again forget God and start worshiping idols and straying away from the covenant. But also on the family level, a huge tragedy is about to take place and break apart Gideon's family legacy. And before we start unpacking it and understanding it, let's just read it in the text. Let's just see what it is. Let me just put it in context and say that in the chapter that describes the end of Gideon's life, chapter 8, which we mostly covered last week, we hear that Gideon or Yerubal, as he was called sometimes, had 70 sons and a son of a concubine from Shechem, from the city of Shechem. And his name is Avimelech. Ironically, this name means my father is king. And as we remember from last time, Gideon rejected the idea that he and his children after him will be kings. So it's somewhat curious that his son is named my father is king. Curious or ominous? And I think ominous takes the cake when we read the following passage. I'm in box number one. Avimelech, son of Yerubal, went to his mother's brothers in Shechem and spoke to them unto the whole clan of his mother's family. He said, put this question to all the citizens of Shechem. Which is better for you, to be ruled by 70 men, by all the sons of Yerubal, or to be ruled by one man? I want to pause here. We will read it through, but I want to pause here and point out that even though Gideon didn't take the kingship, the rulership, when it was offered to him, still, it seems that people think of his sons as having some power to rule over them, which tells us something about the gap between Gideon's intentions and what is actually taking place in reality after his death. But let's see what Avimelech means by making this suggestion, by asking them whether they should be ruled by 70 people or one man. And remember, I am your own flesh and blood. It actually doesn't say flesh and blood. It says flesh and bone, which is important. We'll come back to that. His mother's brothers said all this in his behalf to all the citizens of Shechem. They take what was a family conversation and make it a citywide conversation. And they, that is the city people of Shechem, were won over to Avimelech, for they thought, he is our kinsman. In Hebrew it says, Achinu, he is our brother. And now comes the truly horrific conclusion of this negotiation. They gave him 70 shekels from the temple of Baal Brit. It's a very interesting word here. Baal is a god, an idol, a type of god that was worshipped in Israel at the time. Brit is covenant. It's almost as if we take these two words and put them together, and it probably refers to a certain house of worship to the Baal that existed at the time, but it also just feels especially sacrilegious to juxtapose the name of a different god, not our god, Baal, and the word brit, covenant, which is the thing that we owe our god. So they take 70 shekels from this temple, and with this, Avimelech hired some worthless and reckless fellows, and they followed him. Then he went to his father's house in Ophrah, in Shomron hills, and killed his brothers, the sons of Yerubal, 70 men on one stone. Only Yotam, the youngest son of Yerubal, survived because he went into hiding. I have to say, verse 5 here, Pasuk Hey, always seems to me as if it's just too short to contain such shocking information. There's all the build-up, the conversation with the Shechem, hiring the empty and the reckless, worthless, reckless people. All of this takes time. And then the actual drama, the actual murder of 70 men, not just 70 men, 70 of his brothers on one stone takes place within a few words. Now, forgive me for sharing shocking information or making it this shocking information even more acute, but this little detail that they were killed on one stone tells us a lot. Because without this detail, we might have assumed that it was a battle. That he brought his troop, they attacked, and they killed his brothers wherever they found them. Once we know that they were killed on one stone, we have to change our image of events. It's no longer a battle where people die in different positions while fighting for their lives. No, this is an execution stone. This means that people are taken from wherever they're captured, tied up, brought there and killed on one stone. This means that the whole process was cold, prolonged, that the brothers saw each other's death as it was happening. And all of that is contained in this short verse. The biblical narrative really is an expert, or the biblical storyteller here is an expert on sharpening the shock by making it condensed, by not giving us time to absorb it, but rather punching us to the gut. Beyond the horror of it, beyond just the terror of a son of Gidon turning on his brothers and killing most of Gidon's progeny except himself and one more son, the way Avimelech embarks on this project of destruction includes various allusions to other biblical stories. Many. It's very dense. For five verses, it's extremely dense with allusions. And these allusions both foreshadow what's going to happen with this project, how badly it's going to end for Avimelech, as we will see in a little bit, and also opens up certain themes that have to do with brotherhood and parenthood that give us keys to understanding the era of the judges. So what I would suggest to do today is, first of all, to unpack these allusions, see how these five verses allude to other stories and what it means for Avimelech's future, how it foreshadows, and then see how all of these allusions bite him in the end and actually come to pass. To start with, I want to point out that when Avimelech goes to Shechem, to his mother's brother, I'm highlighting it here in the Hebrew, and he goes to them to talk about his brothers, In many ways, he is echoing a different brother who was sent or went to Shechem to deal with a matter that has to do with brotherhood. And that is Yosef. Before Yosef was sold, before Yosef became a Mishneh LaMelech in Egypt, before all those events took place, Yosef was living at home with his father Israel, Yaakov, and sent to Shechem in order to check on his brothers. And the wording is very, very beautiful in Genesis 37, and he's still in box one. Israel said to Joseph, "Your brothers are pasturing at Shechem. Come, I will send you to them." He answered, "I am ready." Except what he actually says is hineni, that one potent word that means here I am, which in Tanakh appears whenever someone makes himself entirely available for someone else, entirely at the service of someone else. Avraham says hineni to God over and over again. Shmuel says hineni not to God, but to Eli, his mentor, over and over again. Time and again, we see that when someone says hineni, it doesn't mean just, oh, technically here I am, by the way. It means I am here for you. And when Yosef hears that his father wants to send him to Shechem to check on his brothers, he says, here I am for it. Even though we already know that they have a complicated relationship, the dreams already took place, the ornamental tunic already took place, Yosef bringing bad reports about his brothers to his father already took place. We already know that the brothers, it's in a previous psukim, in previous verses, don't talk to Yosef. They're not on speaking terms because they hate him so much and are so jealous of him for his father's favor, their father's favor. And yet, despite all that, Yosef makes himself available to go to his brothers. And then Israel, Yaakov, qualifies the mission as another layer. He says in verse 14, and he said to him, "Go and see how your brothers are and how the flocks are faring, and bring me back word." The wording in Hebrew is a little bit more, I think, potent. He says, "Re'eh et shlom echecha." It technically does mean how they are and what they're doing, but it also means their peace in a deep sense, shalom. So when he is sent to look for shlom echav, it's not just, oh, look at them from afar. It means go and ascertain their state of mind. Go in peace and come in peace. And then come back to me. Joseph heads out to Shechem with this purpose, this mission, fully accepted by him with his hineni. And as he goes to find his brothers, we find that he doesn't find them. He gets to Shechem, but he can't find them anywhere there. And then as he wanders around looking for them, he runs into a person who's never named in the text, and has a whole long conversation with this person who asks him, "Why are you looking for your? Who are you looking for? What are you doing here?" And eventually sends him to where his brothers moved on to. And the rabbis asked, "Why do we need this long conversation? What does that have to do with anything? Why not just say he didn't find them in Shechem, so he went on to Dothan? Why do we need a few verses that describe running into a stranger?" And the commentators have many, many answers, but I want to focus on the simplest one, the one that has to do with the literary character of the text, and it's an answer that Rabbi Yonatan Grossman writes about in his book about Yosef, his relatively new book about Yosef, where he points out that by seeing Yosef removed from the context of his family, talking to a stranger, we get a glimpse into his internal world that isn't shaded by the dynamics within the family. We see how he presents himself when he's not trying to impress his father or in competition with his brothers. And what he reveals there is a simple desire for his brothers, a simple desire to find his brothers. I'm going to go on here in verse 15. "A man came upon them, wandering in the fields. The man asked them, 'What are you looking for?'" In Hebrew, he says, "Matevakesh," which is more than "what are you looking for." It's "what do you want? What are you asking for? What do you crave?" He answered, Et chai anochi mevakesh. I am looking for my brothers. And this is the moment when he's not posturing for anyone, when he's not, you know, trying to collect brownie points with his father for being a dutiful filial son. That's what he says to a total stranger that he's never seen and never going to see again. What he craves is his brothers. When we have this journey of a man earnestly looking for his brothers, desiring their peace, to find out their state of mind, their shalom, their peace, in the back of our mind, suddenly the journey that Avimelech takes to Shechem, also thinking about his brothers, but seeking not their peace, but rather their death, takes an even more grotesque character. But it's not just that the two stories are juxtaposed. It's not just that they're in counterpoint and that the Yosef story highlights how terrible what Avimelech is doing is. Because, let's be frank, you don't need any illustration for how terrible it is. It's pretty clearly terrible in and of itself, as we said before. But it does something more than that. Because as anyone who read the Joseph story knows, Joseph's desire to find his brothers is not answered with love and acceptance and mutual friendship from them. When they see him, they decide to kill him. That his desire to find them is answered in violence. And only later, after they start attacking him, do they decide to mitigate the killing to first throwing him into a pit and then selling him to the Ishmaelim and Midianim. So the desire for brotherhood is not going to end well for Yosef. When we see Avimelech walking to Shechem with a desire to do something bad to his brothers, not only are we seeing that he's very different from Yosef, but the ending of Yosef's mission hangs over our heads. And as we will see, for Avimelech too, this will end in violence. Not just the violence he inflicts, but later the violence that will be inflicted upon him. But this is only one allusion. And the hint of violence to come is highlighted by another allusion that is even more explicit because it has to do with the word choice of this text. If we look together, and I'm once again in box one, and I want to look together at the wording that Avimelech uses when he talks to the city of Shechem, when he talks to his uncles in particular. What he says, and I'm talking not about the part about, is it better for you for 70 men or one man, etc. What he says is, uzchaltem, and remember, ki atzmechem ubesolchem ani. I am your own flesh and bone. I'm your own bone and flesh. This sentence, almost exactly, or this expression that somebody is someone else's bone as flesh, first appears in Tanakh in the second chapter of Genesis. And then it is a very beautiful moment. It is the moment in the bottom source of box two. It is the moment when Adam wakes up from his God-induced slumber and sees the woman whom God has created for him out of his own rib, after taking Adam to name all the animals so that Adam himself sees that there's no helpmeet for him, there's no companion for him amongst the animals, and comes to be aware of his aloneness. And then he goes to sleep, and then he wakes up, and there she is, a woman who is made for him, quite literally. And he exclaims in excitement and says the following. Then the man said, this one at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. Etzem etzamai ubasa mi besari. This one shall be called woman, for from man was she taken. This is a very interesting moment because it denotes for us, or it heralds for us, two very different new phenomena in the world, so to speak. The first is intimacy. Until this moment in Genesis, we see God creating the world. We see man standing alone. In the previous chapter.
Thank you. Is the male in?
Sorry, can I ask everybody to mute themselves, please? Thank you. In the first chapter of Genesis, men and women are created together, but they never talk to each other. They're just beings that are created together. They never speak. There's no relationship between them. In the second chapter of Genesis, in the second iteration of the same story of creation, Adam is created alone. So there's Adam, and there's God, and there's the animals, but there's no intimacy anywhere. There's no relationship. There's no real contact. And then when man looks at woman and recognizes her as part of himself, as somehow connected to him, intimacy, the possibility of closeness, of connection, of companionship comes into the world. At the same time, as Judy Klitzner points out in her book, Subversive Sequels, hierarchy comes into the world. Because Adam is naming his wife. He is giving her a name. He is deciding that she is the appropriate companion for him. He is the one who experienced loneliness and therefore has desire to enter this intimacy. We don't know what she wants. We don't know what she feels. And there's some hint of lack of symmetry between the two. But however asymmetric their relationship, it is nothing compared to the next point in history, in biblical history, when the expression bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh appears, which is in a different scene, a different place, in a meeting between an uncle and a nephew. In this case, the uncle is Lavan, brother of Rivka, and the nephew is Yaakov. Yaakov has just had to leave home because he stole the blessings and his father desires to kill him. He arrives to Haran Naharaim. He meets Rachel by a well. He miraculously removes the rock of the well and gives water to all her sheep and kisses her and cries. We're not going to focus on any of that right now. And then he meets his uncle. And here are the glowing terms in which this meeting is described. I'm in the top of box two. On hearing the news of his sister's son, Jacob, Laban ran to meet him. He embraced him and kissed him and took him into his house. He told Laban all that had happened. He now was Yaakov. And Laban said to him, "You are truly my bone and flesh." Now it says here, when he, I think most translators would say that it says here, and he stayed with him a month time. Now, if we were to pause the story here at the word time, this would all sound very positive, right? I mean, Yaakov is here all alone. He had to leave his family behind. He's in a new place. He's in a place with new costumes that he doesn't know. And here comes this man who runs to him and hugs him and listens to him. Imagine how refreshing it must have been to be listened to in this moment in time after all the turbulence of the family drama he left behind. And calls him bone and flesh and invites him to stay with him. What a beautiful example of Avraham-like hospitality, right? Except that as the story develops, we slowly discover that when Lavan says, "You are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh," his words and his actions don't go along. Or should I, I'll put it differently. The fact that he calls someone bone and flesh doesn't mean that he has good intentions towards the someone. First, we will see that the language of kinship starts diluting and becoming a language of contract, of trade. We see it in the very next verse, in 15. Lavan said to Jacob, "Just because you are a kinsman, should you serve me for nothing? Tell me, what shall your wages be?" Now, I want to point out that at this point, Lavan still frames his request or his suggestion in terms that present him as the benevolent one, as the one who doesn't want to exploit the son of his sister, his nephew, someone who wants to take his nephew into his, who doesn't want to take advantage, right? And yet the fact is that he changes the language of kinship to the language of employment. And then when Jacob tells him that he wants Rachel and he will work for 7 years in order to receive Rachel, famously, Laban cheats him, and when it's time for the wedding 7 years later, switches out Rachel for her elder sister, Leah. And in the morning, when Jacob sees that it is Leah and not Rachel, Laban says the following outrageous statement. I'm in verse 25. When morning came, there was Leah. So he said to Laban, "What is this you have done to me? I was in your service for Rachel. Why did you deceive me?" Laban said, "It is not the practice in our place to marry off the younger before the older." Once again, Laban is hiding behind terms that present him as benevolent and good. "I am guarding the customs of the place." Furthermore, that this norm, it's clearly in place to protect the older sister. Because imagine it does in that time in the ancient world, if the younger sister marries first, everybody will say there must be something wrong with the older sister and she might end up unmarried and childless. So Laban again presents himself here as the one who upholds the law, who upholds the good, who does the right thing, except of course he should have said that 7 years ago. He should have explained that. There's no way to ignore the fact that he is being deceitful and exploitative. And this goes on and on and on in the relationship between Jacob and Laban, the relationship that starts under the auspices of the expression "bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh," and looks like it's going to be a loving kinship relationship, becomes first employment, then deception. Then after Jacob finishes working for 14 years, thus earning both Leah, whom he never asked for, and Rachel, who he wanted, he makes a new contract with Laban, and once again Laban tries to cheat him out of his fruits of his labors, and only because Jacob shows a lot of ingenuity in animal husbandry, which I'm not going to go into right now, only because of that, and because God favors him, is Jacob successful despite Laban's sabotage. And eventually, where it leads is violence. Let us see that together. And we will later see how the same trajectory is implied in Avimelech's story. When Jacob, at some point, Jacob sees that Laban looks at him with bad eyes, and he consults with his wives, and they agree together that it's time to go. That it's time to run away. They sneak out. In the words of the Tanakh here, I'm in box 3, Barach Yaakov. Jacob had fled. The fact that they're fleeing tells us that they didn't simply want to leave, that they expected to be stopped. They expected not to be able to leave. The exploitative tendencies of Laban wouldn't have let them just leave. When Laban finds out, he takes pursuit. On the third day, Laban was told that Jacob had fled, so he took his kinsmen with him and pursued him a distance of 7 days, catching up with him in the hill country of Gilead. But God appeared to Laban the Aramean in a dream by night and said to him, "Beware of attempting anything with Jacob, good or bad." Now, God doesn't reveal himself willy-nilly to every Joe Schmo in the Bible. And I don't think that at this point we can all agree that Laban didn't exactly conduct himself as such a righteous man that we would say, oh, he is worthy of divine revelation, right? So the fact that God makes the effort or makes the decision to reveal himself with such a stern warning to Laban tells us that if it wasn't for that, there would have been violence. Laban would have attacked Yaakov, and in the best case scenario, would have taken all his possessions and wives and children and left him destitute. Worst case scenario, would have killed him or hurt him or maimed him in some terrible way. And Jacob knows that. when Lavan comes and confronts him, the next day when he reaches him and confronts him and tries to say, how could you take my daughters away without letting me say goodbye, etc., etc., Jacob has enough. And he makes a long speech in which he summarizes very succinctly and very clearly their entire relationship and all the many times that Lavan cheated him and deceived him and tried to sabotage his success. And when Lavan hears all of that, he makes a fascinating, fascinating statement that in many ways, I think, summarizes Lavan's attitude for life and sheds new light on the expression he used about bone and flesh. He says, I'm here at verse 43. Then Lavan spoke up and said to Jacob, the daughters are my daughters. The children are my children. And the flocks are my flocks. All that you see is mine. And here he reveals his true philosophy. Lavan is the one who thinks that everything is his. And the only question isn't, is it by right somebody else's or not? The only relevant question is, does he have the power to take it? And if he has the power to take it, then he takes it. And here he doesn't have the power to take it. He still makes his claim. He still speaks in this grandiose language, but he can't follow up on it. So instead, he suggests some sort of covenant or an agreement, a gentleman's agreement to Jacob. He says, let's make a pile of rocks here, and it will mark a line between me and you. I shan't cross to your side. You shan't cross to my side. Let us part as friends. And this is exactly what they do. They use stones to avert violence, which, of course, since we are about to compare Avimelech's story and Lavan's story, reminds us that in Avimelech's case, stone was used for violence. This was the site of violence. In the Jacob story, a stone averts the violence only by God's grace, only because God intervened in this story and said there will not be the natural consequence of all of this attitude of everything is mine if I can take it, is not going to come to pass because I, God, am forbidding it. Now, once we see this in fullness, I think we can go back to the expression bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh and recognize that there is something ominous in it. Because while it looks benevolent and benign, bone of my bone, flesh of my flesh, my kinship, my part of myself, it also implies in it some of Lavan's philosophy of everything is mine. You are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh. But what he means is not, and therefore you are my kinsman and I will take care of you and have a duty of care towards you. What he means by that rather is, and therefore everything you are and can be and can produce is mine as well. I can control it. I can take it. It's an expression of rapacity, rapaciousness, not of love and respect and care of any sort. So when we hear that expression on the lips of Avimelech, I'm going back to box one, in a conversation, once again, between nephew and uncles, except, of course, this time it's the nephew who says it and not the uncles, it tells us something very, very important. It tells us that even if Avimelech is honest right now in his conversation with Shechem, we can't trust him. We can't trust him, and they shouldn't trust him. Because when people say, you are bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh, or I am bone of your bone and flesh of your flesh, this should ring red alert in our mind. And, sorry. We have reason to suspect that not only will it be followed by deceit, but that somewhere down the line, it will lead to violence. And I'm going to do a little bit of a spoiler now and say that not only will it lead to violence from Avimelech towards the people of Shechem, but it will also lead to violence towards Avimelech himself, a violence that will kill him with a stone, literally, in a measure-for-measure moment. Just as he killed his brothers on a stone, he will die hit by a rock. but we will get to that later. I want to also point out that while we're talking about reasons for the people of Shechem to suspect them or to distrust them, which they're not attuned to, they're not aware of it, they do trust him. The fact that they like Avimelech, that their hearts are swayed to his cause, as it says in verse 3, Vayet libam achrei Avimelech, their heart sways or turns towards Avimelech, after Avimelech, hangs on one fact. Ki amru, because they said, Achinuhu, he is their brother. How ironic that they think brotherhood is a reason to trust him, when his project, the project that requires their cooperation, is killing his brothers. If I come and tell you, come and help me kill my brothers because you have brotherly relationship with me, should that inspire confidence? I think not. And yet they seem entirely deaf to the irony of their compliance here, to the irony of their conviction. Before we delve in and see how things play out and how all these allusions and all these, all of us are familiar with Chekhov's adage that if there's a gun in the first act, it will shoot by the third or fifth act. That if there's something dangerous appearing in the first act, it will happen. It will take place later. So we will later see how all these allusions that, flash these alerts of deception, violence, bad things coming, loss of trust ahead, will in fact take place. I want to point out that there's another layer of allusion. There's another earlier story echoing here. And that has to do with Shechem itself. It's not only about the brotherhood of Joseph. It's not only about the deception and violence between a different set of uncle and nephew. It is also the place where it's all taking place, because Shechem in our memory, in Jewish memory, in biblical memory, is a place of broken promises and violence. This is the place where once upon a time, the prince of the city kidnapped Jacob's daughter Dinah and raped her. Later, tried to negotiate a marriage agreement with her brothers and father, during which negotiations Dinah's brothers, sons of Jacob, said, if you all circumcise yourself, we will let you keep her and intermarry with you and intermingle with you more generally. And then, after the men of the city circumcised themselves, went and killed them all, looted the city, and took the women and children as slaves, as captives. So this is a place where we already saw both violence and broken promises. And this theme, this, or I should say really a cluster of themes and ominous images, is hanging over our head as we watch Avimelech seemingly succeed in carrying off his coup and taking over the rulership of this area, becoming the ruler, the king, as his name implies, of this area. And indeed, at first it looks like he is successful. I'm going to move forward to box 5 and read what follows. All the citizens of Shechem and all Beit Milo convened, and they proclaimed Avimelech king at the terebinth of the pillar at Shechem. So on the face of it, like many other heroes of tragedies after him, Avimelech gets exactly what he asked for. Macbeth becomes king. And, there's so many classic tragic stories that start exactly like that, with someone wanting something and getting it. But the cost that was hinted by all those allusions, the cost will come knocking. And the first hint we get that, in fact, the cost is not forgotten, that he didn't get away with it, has to do with that younger son, Yotam, who survived the massacre by hiding. I want to point out a little difference here between what we might call normal entertainment-focused storytelling and biblical storytelling, because in a normal hero's journey type of story, think Star Wars, think Harry Potter, when we hear that, and I'm at the first source again, and the end of the fifth verse, only Yotam, the youngest son of Yerubal, survived because he went into hiding. We might well expect that then that younger son will go out, learn how to be a warrior, come back and avenge the death of his kin, right? But that's not what happens. Yotam doesn't come to avenge his brothers. In fact, he doesn't do anything to Avimelech. We don't see him taking any physical actions at all. The only thing he does is upon the occasion of Avimelech's coronation, anointment, making a speech. He goes on top of the mountain, Mount Gerizim, ironically, the mountain of blessing in our topography. When people came to Israel from Egypt, they were to stand on Mount Eval and Mount Gerizim, the two mountains overlooking Shechem. And on Mount Eval, read the curses that will happen if we don't follow the covenant, and on Har Gerizim, the blessings that will happen if we do follow the covenant. So he goes to the mountain of blessing and instead informs the people that they are cursed. And the way he does it is by telling them a parable. And it's a beautiful parable. Let's read it together quickly. I am going to start, I'm in book 6, I'm going to start in verse 8. Once the trees went to anoint a king over themselves. They said to the olive tree, "Reign over us." But the olive tree replied, "Have I, through whom God and men are honored, stopped yielding my rich oil that I should go and wave above the trees?" Note that kingship here is presented as something negative, as a, something pointless. Wave above the kings, you know, the trees. Just wave myself, be above them, be important. Much better to continue doing productive, important things in the world than to go and waste my time on the appearance of power. So the trees said to the fig tree, "You come and reign over us." But the fig tree replied, "Have I stopped yielding my sweetness, my delicious fruit, that I should go and wave above the trees?" So the trees said to the vine, "You come and reign above us." But the vine replied, "Have I stopped yielding my new wine, which gladdens God and men, that I should go and wave above the trees?" Then all the trees said to the thorn bush, the atad, "You come and reign over us." Maybe they thought that they need to find someone who doesn't have a job description yet, who doesn't give anything productive to humanity yet. Somebody with an opening in their timetable. And the thorn bush said to the trees, "If you are acting honorably in anointing me king over you, come and take shelter in my shade. But if not, may fire issue from the thorn bush and consume the cedars of Lebanon." After this, Yotam tells him, "If you did right to take Avimelech and kill my father's other sons, may you enjoy his kingship. But if not, fire will come out of him and burn you." And after saying that, with that, Yotam fled. He ran to Be'er and stayed there because of his brother Avimelech. Mipnei, out of fear of his brother Avimelech. What Yotam achieves with this parable is twofold. First and foremost, and this I think goes beyond the context of the family drama unfolding here and really cuts to the heart of the book and its messages, he points out to the people that when you establish your relationships, your way of life, your society on certain terms, you can't escape the consequences of those terms. Once they accepted Avimelech's rule on the terms of power and violence, because this is what it took to establish in this king, power, violence, kin murder, and of course, ingratitude towards Gideon, whose children they enabled him to murder, even though Gideon saved them from the Midianites. Once they establish him as king on these terms, this will be the terms that he rules them on. His reign will be a reign of blood and ingratitude and murder, as it will be. We will see that in a moment. And this, of course, extends beyond the moment, because in many ways, this should be almost the title of the book, the title of the era. Time and time again, the people establish a society on erroneous terms. They establish their life on the idea that you can worship many gods, on the idea that people should take care of themselves first and foremost. We will talk a lot about that in following weeks. On the idea that every tribe should worry about their own interests and have nothing to do with the others. And they can't escape the consequences. The consequences are that they can't find the strength to fight wars effectively. They can't find the wherewithal to establish better memory and kinship moving forward. They can't establish a kind of kindness that allows a people to function together. Because once they establish themselves on terms of coldness to one another and ingratitude to God and apathy towards a covenant, the consequence will keep coming back. The consequence is inescapable. And what we will see as the book progresses is that the question starts knocking on the door. The question is, how do we get out of this? How do we resolve the cycle of the judges era? Just another victory in the name of God clearly isn't enough, because time and time again, it's followed by forgetfulness and betrayal of God. Something needs to change in the terms of the social contract itself. Later in the book is going to hint that the thing that needs to change is the rise of kingship. Because as we will see in the last two classes of this course, the repeating refrain in the last few stories of the book are, in those days there was no king. Each man did what was right in their own eyes, or straight, really, in their own eyes. So when you hear that enough, in juxtaposition with all kinds of horrible stories about horrible crimes, horrible betrayals, you start realizing, oh, maybe the storyteller is telling me something, namely that a king will be that something that breaks the pattern and allows a new era to rise. But Mashal Yotam, the story, the parable that Yotam shares with us here, doesn't only hint to us that terms of the social contract need to change. It also hints to us that kingship in and of itself is not enough. Because kingship on terms can be on these evil terms too. Kingship can be like the kingship of Avimelech, the kingship of a thorn bush that doesn't have anything positive to contribute to society. And that kind of kingship will only end in fire and violence. And that is exactly what happens to Avimelech and the Baraishan. What happens is that for a while, everything is great. Avimelech is the king of that area. But then the people of Shechem start feeling not so happy with his rule anymore. They start grumbling. They start feeling that maybe they shouldn't have accepted him as their king. And then a man shows up, a man who has nothing to do with the story until this point and nothing to do with it later, a man named Gaal. He shows up in Shechem. He drinks wine with the leaders of Shechem. And in their drunken stupor, starts bad-mouthing Avimelech and saying, maybe we should rebel against him. And this leads to a war between Avimelech and the city of Shechem, a war in which Gaal himself, by the way, runs away scot-free. Dr. Neria Klein from Har Etzion says that the point here is to show that Gaal is not the issue. It's really God intervening to bring about the fulfillment of Yotam's Mashal, the fulfillment of the consequences of Avimelech's action, the fulfillment of all those promises made by those allusions to other older stories. Because what happens is that Avimelech sets siege to the city of Shechem, leads his people in collecting wood, collecting trees, cutting trees from the mountains, piling them up around the city and specifically around the tower of the city where the people are hiding, and burning them alive, burning the whole city alive. In this way, bringing about that promise of violence, bringing into fruition that promise of violence and betrayal and broken promises that we saw hidden in the parallel with Lavan, and in the memory of Shechem as a place of broken promises and violence. But that is not the end of the story, because it's not enough to punish Avimelech alone, right? This action, this moment when he kills, murders in a horrific way his oldest supporters, doesn't go unnoticed by the other people he rules over. And everyone starts rebelling. Everyone freaks out. Everyone doesn't really want Avimelech to be their king anymore, because a king who burns his own subjects is not a king you want to have. And so Avimelech starts a journey of subduing the rebellion in other places. And in the very next place where he goes, he meets his just measure for measure. I am going to skip to box 7, the third source. But a woman dropped an upper millstone on Avimelech's head and cracked his skull. As he comes towards the wall to lay siege, the people of the city see him. They know what happened to the other city he laid siege on. And the people have no intention to let that pass. And so the man who killed 70 brothers on one stone is killed by a stone in the end. Now, what does it all mean? Why is it significant? Why do we need the Avimelech story? In many ways, it seems like an odd story to fit in the book of Judges, because he's not a judge in the proper sense of the word. He's not fighting against other nations to save Israel like the other judges do. It's almost as if there's a long foray into something else. But to answer this question, to understand really why it's important to have Avimelech, beyond the points I made already about how he brings to our mind both the question of how to get out of this era, what kind of terms we need to establish a social contract on, and the danger of kingship, thus challenging us perhaps to understand why later the book seems to think that kingship is a good idea, and that will be something we'll discuss at great length later in the course. Beyond all of that, Avimelech also is important because in many ways he shows us the other side of the Gideon story. The Gideon story alone is very uplifting and empowering. But we see how within one generation, the great victory, the great success, the great accomplishment becomes corrupted not only by ingratitude towards God, namely by worshiping as an idol this item that Gideon made, but also ingratitude towards Gideon by supporting one brother in killing his other children, Gideon's other children. And this ingratitude, this horrible betrayal, almost encapsulates for us the story of the book. It becomes a mise-en-scene, I forgot the term. It becomes a smaller segment of an item that reflects the entirety of the item. I forgot how it's called. Namely, within this one story, we already see the entire story of the book. When people feel ingratitude, when people forget the source of the benefits and accomplishments they enjoy, be it God or Gideon, what follows is violence. What follows is a corrupted social contract. What follows is a situation where there's no redemption, where the best you can hope for is justice in the sense of measure for measure, not building something good, not building something better. I want to make one final point about how the poetic justice of the rock being used for violence here resonates with themes from Tanakh and from the book. But before that, I want, yeah, microcosm. Thank you, Nancy. Cool. But before that, I will take some of your questions from the chat. So stay with me, and before the hour is over, I will come back to that one final thought. Just a moment. Leah said, like Moshe at the burning bush. Can you elaborate on what you mean, Leah? Are you here? Okay, let's continue. Just a minute. Ben Melech pointed out that stones in a formation are also used for altars to God. That is true. And it's there's actually a lot of there's been some really interesting recent books and articles written about that here in Israel, about how matzeva, gal'ed, and mizbeach, all things that are made of stones, are different. And we don't have time to get into it right now, but it's fascinating that it's clear that people attached at the time great significance, great importance to various formations made of stone, and that what formations you're using, are you using one stone or many stones piled together, meant a lot to them. There's disagreement amongst researchers and amongst commentators about what it meant, but it's a fascinating fact. Gershon Hefner wrote, Paro said the people of Israel were atzum mimeni, a separate part of him, in contrast to Levan, who said that Yaakov was etzem me'atzamai. I think Gershon is pointing out here that there's a play on the root. Etzem and atzum are two different words. Etzem me'atzamai means bone of my bones, and atzum mimeni means greater than me, bigger than me. But the root, etzem, is the same. Let's continue. Mimeni denotes separation from Israel. From is the key part of the word, from Paro, whereas etzem me'atzamai, bone of my bones, indicates that Laban is able to coexist with his own flesh and blood. In spite of what the Agadah says, Laban was really not as bad as Paro. Jacob's Levaya heads for Goren Ha'atad, a kinship threshing floor. They suggest to look in his book, Legal Friction, where he elaborates on that. Thank you, Gershon. Ellen Stone. Oh, the word stone here is very interesting, Alan. Ellen Stone, your name is very appropriate for this class. Another ruler killed by a woman. So thank you for pointing it out. I meant to mention it and I forgot that we already saw Sisra being killed by Yael, and now we see Avimelech being killed by a nameless woman. And I should add that being killed by a woman was considered as the height of dishonor, the most embarrassing thing that could happen to a ruler in those times. And it's almost as if history, or at least the biblical storyteller here, mocks these men who are manly men going about doing their violence, killing people, burning people, subjugating people, but they can't escape their own death. The fact that they are so powerful doesn't mean that they can succeed. And even a woman who is not militant normally in the ancient world can defeat them. It raises an interesting question, because we will later meet a Jewish leader, a good leader, kind of leader, Shimshon, who is also defeated by a woman. And when we get to that point, we'll ask, what does it mean that he joins that club of villains of Avimelech and Sisra? Dalia Hakimi is asking, are the people of Shechem Canaanites, one of the seven nations we should have destroyed? Most commentators believe that yes, that they are not Jewish, they're Canaanites. And that adds another whole layer to the problem here, because we see that Gideon took a concubine who was Canaanite, was from the people we were not supposed to intermingle with, from people we're supposed to push out or eradicate. And when we see that in juxtaposition with the fact that what he created for good purposes was used for worshiping other gods, we see how even a man as dedicated to God as Gideon fails to draw the right boundaries. Okay, so I see that there's other excellent comments. Unfortunately, I can't answer all of them. As before, feel free to email me. I will type my email. Actually, I'm not going to type my email. You can ask Torah and Moshe for my email and email me if you wish. As some of you can testify, I do respond, even if not quickly. I do want to make one final point to tie it all together before I say goodbye to you. Namely, that the stone we meet here, no matter in what formation, the stone that in Levan's case, in Yaakov's case, we saw was a way to avert violence, whereas here it's both the site of the violence that Yimelech commits, and the sight of violence committed against him and killing him in a measure for measure sort of way, is a particularly ironic item to have at the center, or at least bookending, our story. Because in Hebrew, the word even is a combination of the word av and ben, father and son. Something about the word itself evokes this most primal connection between fathers and son. And when we see Avimelech, whose name is my father is king, killing his father's other children and betraying and corrupting his father's legacy, using a Evan, a father's son, in many ways we see here the tragedy of this entire era. The era that, because they lost their memory, the connection from generation to generation that was supposed to guarantee that they remember the covenant, because they lost this ability to connect to the history and meaning of the history of previous generation, turn against each other and tear each other to shreds here, and as we will see later, in civil wars as well. And on that not so happy note, thank you very much and have a wonderful, hopefully violence-free, deception-free rest of the week. And I'm looking forward to resuming our journey on February 20th. Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Rachel.
Thank you, Rachel. So always interesting as usual.
Thank you very much. Thank you. So much to think about.
Mm-hmm. Yes, it's definitely a thought-provoking book.
Ellen said, why is it called Shelby when all they're doing is having a war?
Bye. Shavua Tov. Sorry about my video problems, but hopefully I can work them out. If anyone needs anything, I put the info@torahinmotion.org email address in the bottom of the chat. And wishing everyone a healthy and safe week. Shavua Tov. We'll see you all soon.